great to be here. So thanks a lot for Giffrey and everyone to invite me here. So so I got kind of every day an email from Stephanie Moll asking me for a title and things like that. And I didn't know what I wanted to talk about. So but I have some special, I programmed a special button on my computer. So I just kind of copied and pasted their sentence. And if I push this one button, it just says in Matrix Prolog States. So that's the way I have been giving talks forever. And so this, so I'm, I want to talk a little bit about some very new work that we have been doing in trying to understand entanglement. And in strongly correlated quantum many-body systems, but also in kind of trying to go beyond the matrix product state paradigm somehow. So what we have seen is that, of course, these matrix product states and the MRG is extremely powerful in uncovering somehow ground state properties. But at the end, in a real experiment, of course, you want to go beyond ground states, what you will probe or excitations and things like that. And actually, this whole formalism of matrix product states and PEPs and generalizations is very well suited actually also for going beyond just ground states, for trying to build up a Hilbert space of your elementary excitations. And this is one of the things I want to explain. But so an overview, I would very briefly talk a little bit about gap quantum phases, area laws, some new work that is related to the very nice talk that we heard yesterday on entanglement rates. Then a bit about quasi-adiabatic evolution. This is a kind of a very nice mathematical formalism that was introduced by Matthew Hastings to describe states in the same phase. We'll talk about the stability of the area law. And then I will kind of shift complete gears. So this is actually the entanglement part, and this would be somehow the emergence part. So how kind of do particles emerge out of this kind of matrix product or whatever vacuum, tensor product state vacuum? Okay, so the library of exotic phases will be filled with a wealth of strongly correlated quantum systems within the near future. That's at least what we hope. And there's still lots of work, as we have seen yesterday, or this morning, actually, by the very nice talk of Leon. So, but we would like to understand somehow a few of the basic features of such systems. So, for example, what is this area law? Can we kind of make this a little bit more precise? Why is the area law kind of such a good thing? Is there any way in which this is stable and in which somehow this is something that is insensitive to perturbations? So because this, if there's one thing that that condensed matter physicists have learned us, kind of quantum information people, is that somehow it only makes sense to talk about things that are robust. Okay, so is that actually true for the area law? Because we know that entanglement entropy itself is extremely non-robust. Okay, somehow a tiny change in a state can lead to a completely different entropy. So why is it that we use area laws and something that is a completely non-robust quantity? So we want to understand get some deeper insight actually in these questions. Then other things that we could ask is what about the elementary excitations? What is the, so once you know the ground state, what kind of can we make any rigorous claims of how elementary excitations will look like? Is there some notion of locality? Because the advantage of this whole tensor product state language is actually that we are able to simulate or to describe strongly correlated systems in real space. And as far as I understand, this has never really been done before. And now you can really make use of these new kind of, the fact that you work in real space, if you can, it would be great if indeed somehow low-lying excited states have some notion of locality. And indeed, we'll be able to show that this is possible. Okay, so what do we know about area laws? So let's start for gap quantum systems in one dimension. And Hastings actually proved a very nice theorem that indeed, any kind of, if you kind of calculate the entanglement entropy of a block, if this block becomes larger and larger in a quantum spin system, then actually this obeys an area law. Okay, recently, there's very recent work by actually computer scientists who got very interested in this question, and they got a very, very kind of good improvement on the bounds that Hastings, they got an exponential improvement on the bounds of Hastings, and they showed actually that the entropy scaling is effectively somehow inversely proportional with the gap. Okay, so the up to a constant, you can actually prove that this is an upper bound, and this upper bound can be saturated. So this is the best bound you can get. So it means that indeed the entanglement entropy kind of has a dependence on the smaller the gap is, the larger the entanglement entropy will be, but somehow nevertheless, if I have a finite gap, this is finite. So the bound that Hastings actually proved was exponential in one over. Okay, so I will not really make this statement rigorous, but somehow the whole interest or the whole kind of theoretical interest in matrix product states is kind of based on the fact that somehow there's very few entanglements. Somehow the entanglement in these strongly correlated systems is exponentially less than you would kind of guess naively. Somehow, even for critical systems. So even if you have a critical system, the entanglement of that block will only grow kind of linearly, logarithmic, sorry, in the size of the block. While a random state, somehow the entanglement entropy would grow linearly in that block. So there's very, very few degrees of freedom that actually matter for describing quantum many-body systems. And this is exactly somehow what these matrix product states seem to capture. Yes?
Sorry, what's d? Small d?
Small d is the local dimension of your... So in the case of qubits, this DS2.
Look, I'm not really correlation that problem.
But somehow there's of course so using similar techniques, you can prove that there's a connection between the gap and the correlation length. Namely, they are connected via the Lie-Probenson bonds. Okay, for the Lie-Probenson velocity. Sorry. So these two things have a kind of a strong dependence on each other. And certainly in relativistic theories, these two things are completely equivalent. But in quantum spin systems, you have to go via this machinery of Lie-Probenson bonds, but at the end, they also turn out to be very much related. Yes?
So it's still exponentially worse than what we know for CFDs.
Indeed. So, but there are examples known, actually. I think, Daniel Gottesman, I don't know if he's in the other. So Daniel kind of came up with translation invariant quantum spin systems that have exactly an entanglement entropy that saturates.
What's wrong with these things? They have like...
Well, they're gapped, so they have strangely gapped kind of. Okay, so what about area laws in higher dimensions? Actually, there nothing has been proven somehow. But we certainly believe that there's also area laws there. Like if you have a two-dimensional system, you calculate the entanglement entropy of a block, then you expect that the entanglement will kind of grow like the size of the boundary of the block. And actually also, again, Hastings has proven that under some conditions, like if you make some kind of assumption of the density of states above the gap and things like that, you can actually make this more rigorous somehow. And therefore, we would like to kind of make the same claim. Well, that means that basically this kind of local way of parameterizing your wave functions should be enough to describe all these gapped phases. But in recent years, it turns out that we are not so sure of that anymore. So especially somehow if you have systems that have some chiral order, like Laughlin type of states, it's not clear at all that somehow this can be captured by these tensor product states. And then might be that you have to go beyond that. So these are the kind of questions that... that we don't know, and it's just, so many people have tried to prove area laws in two dimensions, but really from a mathematical physics point of view, and this it turns out to be an extremely hard problem. So anyway, somehow, in this talk, I want to kind of do something much more modest, okay, something much simpler. I just want to get some understanding: is there indeed some notion of stability of an area law, or can I at least prove that if one state in a certain phase obeys an area law, that all the other states in that same phase would also obey an area law, independent of the dimension. Okay, and this was actually never known. So of course, for this, I need first a definition of what does it mean to be in the same phase, and I just use the standard definition. Somehow we define two ground states to be in the same phase if there exists one parameter family of local gapped Hamiltonians such that and the starting and the end point of this path correspond to the two ground states, and somehow along this path, the gap remains open. Of course, you can kind of make this a little bit more general, that if you have a ground state manifold, like if you have topological order, then somehow, of course, the degenerate somehow, then you just put that you have four ground states, and that somehow this manifold, this ground state subspace is mapped into the other ground state subspace while the gap remains open. Actually, all these kind of things that we do would also be valid there. And you would think, well, this is probably an easy thing, but it turns out that there's lots of details that you have to do. Because if you take an adiabatic path, you would say, well, I just evolve my kind of ground state adiabatically from one to the other one with an adiabatic path. So I evolve very slowly, and at every step somehow you make a tiny error, but you kind of keep evolving this. Now, the whole problem is that with entropy is that entropy is an extremely unstable technique. So especially if you're interested kind of in the entanglement entropy of let's say you have a very large system and you cut it into two pieces, okay, and you say, okay, this thing goes to infinity, and you say, okay, I'm interested in the entanglement entropy of this half of my system, okay, and two-dimensional thing. So this is a huge kind of thing. Now it happens that two reduced density matrices, rho and sigma, might be extremely close in trace distance. So that means that all the local properties, any correlation function, anything that you can imagine, is kind of extremely close to each other, but the entropy can be very, very different. Okay, this is really an issue. So entropy is something very unstable if you calculate the entropy of an extended object. Okay, because somehow this bond can actually be saturated, and you see that there's a dependence on the dimension of this rho. So if this rho, if your kind of system that you look at is half infinity, and somehow there actually exist states rho and sigma that are extremely close, this can be an arbitrary small number. But if you multiply this with infinity, then somehow the entropy can be very different. And indeed, somehow two states, so entropy is not stable at all. So you'd think that actually this is the worst thing. You would never want to kind of use something like an entropy to describe ground states or to describe somehow reduced density matrix, because two density matrices close to each other can have a completely different entropy. Okay, so this is actually the kind of the type of mathematical problems that you're forced to deal with. Okay, so also, and that means that actually it's not enough to just evolve your system adiabatically. You want to have the exact evolution. So if you kind of go from somehow your Hamiltonian A to B, you want to prove that if this satisfies an area law, then that one also satisfies an area law. You don't want to make epsilon errors along the path, because every kind of epsilon error that you do somehow could in principle be multiplied by the log of the size of that whole kind of thing, and somehow you would be completely dead. Okay, so and for this we will need this kind of notion of quasi-adiabatic evolution, which is actually a Hamiltonian evolution that is exact. So what you do is, instead of evolving with your adiabatic Hamiltonian, you come up with a new Hamiltonian. This is what Matthew Hastings actually showed how to do. You come up with a new Hamiltonian that actually has very long range interactions. Okay, so but the longer range, somehow the farther away these interactions kind of act on, the smaller their weight, the smaller their norm is. Okay, so you have to kind of, if you want to bound somehow the entropy of this thing with respect to this one, you will have to deal with that. You will have to kind of evolve with the exact Hamiltonian and then bound the whole thing. Okay, so for this, actually, you have to prove this. The key in proving this is related to a problem that was a long-standing problem in quantum information theory. Actually, one that I worked, I think this is the first time you met Ifri and myself. We kind of started working on exactly that problem, but this is more than 10 years ago. So and it has to do with the following question. If I have, so this is the system, this small a, big A is the system from which I want to calculate my entanglement entropy. And I have a Hamiltonian evolution, but it only acts on a part of that big system. So this is like, you're only acting on this part, big A, and not on your whole part A. So you're evolving with the Hamiltonian that acts non-trivial here on this block, and you're interested in how does the entanglement of this whole kind of left side change by this evolution. Okay, and so this is basically the problem. You want to bound that. You want to bound how fast can entanglement grow under kind of unitary evolution or Hamiltonian evolution. So this is kind of a brief history of what of the known results. Somehow the first result, this notion of entanglement rate was actually introduced by Wolfgang Dürr, Giffrey, Fidal, and Ignacio Sirac in 2001, and they proved that if you don't have ancillas, so if you don't have any, so if A, the small A is just the empty set, then indeed somehow you can prove things. You can prove that the entanglement rate is actually will kind of be lower bounded by something that scales like the minimum of the log of somehow the dimension of A or of B, and take the minimum of that, and you can prove that this is an upper bound on how much entanglement on the entanglement rate. Now, but what is very interesting is actually that once you introduce ancillas, that this was already pointed out in that paper of Giffrey, somehow that the entanglement rate can be much larger. Okay, somehow the idea is as follows. Somehow, just to give you an idea, that if you have ancillas, actually you can create much more entanglement than if you don't have. So assume that, for example, that you start with two singlets, okay, and then you only can act on these two qubits, okay, and you would act with these two qubits, and you have a Heisenberg interaction. Then you see that by acting with the Heisenberg interaction, you kind of end up with a state that looks like this. So by just acting on two qubits, you actually create two e-bits of entanglement. So you can. So this already shows that this is a very non-trivial question. So if you have ancillas, you can create much more entanglement than if you don't have. Okay, because somehow this entanglement that you originally had can be swapped, and then you have this kind of thing. So and this is basically the mathematical problem that that has to be solved in the case of Hamiltonian evolution. Okay, so actually this was then a conjecture that dates back to a long time, actually. Sergei Brave and Alexei Kitaev, actually, they formally, they said, okay, this has to be true also for the case when you have ancillas. And actually, this bound, once you have this bound, then you fill this in with this quasi-adiabatic evolution, and then indeed you will be able to prove the stability of the area. So let me kind of give a sketch of the proof, just to have some linear algebra in this conference. So it happens that this rate, you can kind of express it as the trace of some kind of Hamiltonian and the commutator. So this is easy to see that indeed you will have a commutator when you kind of calculate how does the entanglement change as a function of time. You take the derivative, you will kind of get commutators. And then there's actually a very nice trick that was also kind of was pointed out by Sergei Brave, is that instead of optimizing somehow over the rho AB and rho A, you can actually optimize over completely different operators, rho AB and rho A, such that, because somehow the only thing you need is that this rho AB is always smaller than somehow the dimension of your block, of the dimension of your kind of Hilbert space of B times the reduced density matrix of A tensor EIB. So this is actually a semi-definite inequality that can easily be proved, and this is actually the key to come up. Yes?
Sorry, just before you go on, is it known that gamma is always greater than zero? That is, that
the
indeterminate will always grow in time?
Well, no, of course, it's a unitary evolution, though, so if it can go up, it can also go down. But we are only interested in upper bounds. And actually, it's a strange thing is actually that there are Hamiltonians for which the entanglement rate is different than if you kind of evolve with minus h. So if you don't have kind of time reversal, then somehow so it might be that somehow an entanglement, the amount of entanglement that can be destroyed can be a different read than the amount of entanglement that can be created by the same Hamiltonian. There's all these kind of strange things. Okay, anyway, so you can formulate this as a problem where you then introduce matrices X, Y, they are based on semi-definite inequalities, and you fill these things in, and then somehow this entanglement rate is kind of a maximization over all the operators that satisfy all these inequalities. You fill this thing in, and you get somehow a nice, of course, this log kind of comes from the entropy, and you fill all these things in, and then you have to distinguish two regimes. And actually, this was just the key to. I'm saying this for the people that are interested in actually understanding how do you prove something. The thing that took us kind of many years to understand is that somehow. We always try to bound this using either Cauchy-Schwarz, either some kind of well-known matrix inequalities, but the whole point was that we just have to divide this sum into two pieces. One piece where somehow these coefficients are smaller than P and the other ones that are larger than P. And once you do that, you kind of just solve the two regimes, some linear algebra that I copy and pasted from our paper, and you end up actually with the result that you wanted to get. So indeed, somehow the entanglement rate between A and somehow the entanglement entropy that changes somehow if you act with the Hamiltonian on this space, but you are calculating the entanglement entropy of the whole thing, changes with some kind of a constant times the norm. So this is actually the operator norm of your Hamiltonian, because of course the stronger this Hamiltonian, this is just a rescaling of what time is. No? So this is the operator norm of the Hamiltonian acting on AB, and then log of the minimum of the dimension of somehow this whole of small a and small, this small part of a and the small part of b. Not, so there's no dependence here at all anymore on this the size of the region small a, which is crucial. So if you want to prove area laws, because you're interested, so you will evolve with the Hamiltonian that only acts here, but you don't want it to depend on the size of your thing that goes to infinity.
But it depends exponentially on the size of the capital A.
No, logarithmically. So logarithmically in the dimension of the Hilbert space. So logarithmically in the dimension of the Hilbert space. That means that it's linear in the number of qubits, let's say.
Yeah, overall, yeah.
So that norm of H doesn't change when you increase the area of the interface?
Well, this is given by your Hamiltonian, no? This is
I'm not sure about the definition, but it's something that doesn't scale with the...
No. Oh wait. So of course, this is for one particular term in your Hamiltonian. So at the end, what the situation that you will have is that you will have a Hamiltonian that is a sum of many terms.
Yeah.
Okay. But what is very clear is that the entanglement rate of this Hamiltonian can be upper bounded by the sum of the entanglement rates of every individual term. And these local terms are of course have no norm. The norm of these local terms does not scale with the system size. These are kind of local operators. And that's why somehow you will get. Because the area, the fact that you get the area will come from this sum I, but this thing will not depend on the area anymore.
Okay, so so how do you use this now to kind of prove anything like the stability of an area law? So for this, you need this quasi-adiabatic evolution that was actually introduced, I think, in a paper of Xiang Wen and Matthew Hastings. This is the first time that it appeared. So it happens that the exact, so given a Hamiltonian and given somehow the fact that psi of t would parameterize the exact ground state of your Hamiltonian along a path, then the magic thing is actually that there is actually something like a Hamiltonian that is much more non-local, but that evolves you along this kind of path exactly. Okay, so it's not, there's no errors. There's no epsilon errors like adiabatic errors. No. This quasi-adiabatic evolution is exact. So given somehow that psi of t is the exact ground state of h of t, then evolving somehow with this Hamiltonian acting on this, you would kind of exactly follow that path. Okay, and the whole trick or the whole kind of genius of Matthew Hastings was to see that this can be written in this form. You kind of just see that this is like the integral over this is related to some Fourier transform, and then you have here e to the ihz some of this. And then you see already, aha, for here I will be able to use Lee Robinson bounds because I will be able to bound this. Where does the gap come in? Because of course we have to assume that there is a gap. Is in the fact that actually this function of z, if you look at the Fourier transform of this, it's completely irrelevant what this Fourier transform is for values of omega smaller than the gap. Okay, so if you look at, because somehow h itself has a gap. So anything, if you take the Fourier transform of that, somehow of that, this is just a function, this is not an operator, so this is a function. So we see that somehow this will be e to the I omega t times this f of z, but this omega somehow can only be eigenvalues of your Hamiltonian. Therefore, the Fourier transform of that function in the gap is completely irrelevant. You can choose it as you want, okay? Because it will not affect somehow this integral, because these eigenvalues don't appear in your Hamiltonian. Okay, and then somehow you just do an optimization. You look for functions that satisfy this and have these conditions. They only have to satisfy somehow that for all omega larger than this minimal gap, they have to do this. And then you can kind of bound these things, and you find that indeed, actually, using the fact that you have a gap, you will be able to make this Hamiltonian quasi-local. So it will be kind of an almost local Hamiltonian. So you will be able to write this kind of Hamiltonian as a sum of terms, and every term can also be written as a sum. But anyway, the norm, what is important is that the norm of every one of these terms kind of decays exponentially fast with as a function of the number of qubits or sites on which this thing is acting. Okay, and then you fill in this kind of this entanglement rate bound that we found before. You fill this kind of thing in, and at the end you end up with somehow proving that the entropy change along your path is bounded by the area, and the area just comes from the fact that you sum your original, the number of terms in your Hamiltonian kind of is the number of terms that cross your kind of border is related to this is to the area times somehow something that actually is all this. So you see here, the gap is appearing, but actually this is the correlation length, so the gap is actually also appearing there. Just to give you a little bit more intuition, if you, what is this? Okay, so assume, so if you do that, if you start with the product state, okay, so if you start with the product state, so you start with an entanglement that is completely zero, and you evolve in that phase, then you can prove that after kind of evolve until time one, that the entropy is bounded by the area by something like log of d, which is the local dimension. This is like in the case of qubits, this should just be, this is always log two, times some kind of an integral of this, and somehow the gap would appear as, so as one over gap with d, the dimension of your space. So if you have a one-dimensional space, then this would be one over the gap to the power four. If you will have a two-dimensional space, it would be one over gamma to the power five, and so forth. So you get these kind of bounds, and this is indeed kind of proving that indeed if the original state satisfies an area law, then actually all the other ones will also satisfy an area law, because somehow the change in entropy along the path only scales like the area. Okay, and there's a lower bound for this change that has to do with this.
What happened to the gap? Are you assuming that the gap is constant?
Well, this gamma is actually the minimal gap along the path. Okay, so of course you can do, if you don't do that, you can get a better bound by including it here in the t and so further. But this is at the end. I'm assuming that this is the lowest gap. Okay, so actually using these techniques, you can indeed also find an exponential improvement on the original proof of Hastings by just saying that in 1D we know that everything is adiabatically connected to a product state by using this whole machinery of, and then you use this, and then you see that indeed you don't have this exponential dependence on the gap, but only polynomial. Okay, so let's see, time is going very fast. So let's not kind of go. So anyway, so this is kind of a small quote of Feynman that kind of had this idea that indeed, if you satisfy an area law, if systems have so few entanglements, right, that's, he of course didn't speak about entanglement, but somehow he had this intuition, then actually the way to simulate these systems, you should not use all the degrees of freedom, you should try to kind of simulate, to parameterize the degrees of freedom on the boundary of your system that you're interested in. And actually, I think, so from my point of view, so what Steve White did, and then also these, all these tensor product states are kind of really kind of explicit realizations of this visionary idea that Feynman had of how to kind of parameterize your degrees of freedom at the border and not as border as kind of holographic degrees of freedom and not as bulk degrees of freedom. This is actually all these DMRG and PS PEPS methods can really be understood in such a language. Okay, so people have already said this. So what about the part of emergence? Because the title had so there was two parts in the title. And actually, the what I will talk about now is work that has mainly been done by Jutta Hagemann. So we kind of have been discussing these issues that I will talk about now for many years now. And I think now it's now all these kind of problems have become very very clear, and somehow we are finally able to write them down. So for example, there's a paper today exactly on these things that I will talk about now. So in some sense, if you have unique ground state, then somehow the vacuum, as you all know, is really empty. No, that's exactly that's the point of the ground state. It's that there's nothing there. So you cannot see it because it's the ground state. So you're interested actually. Of course, we have seen actually it should kind of. Of course, if you have topological order, that's not entirely true. As we saw this morning, you have these different. Whatever if you have topological order, you have non-trivial kind of evolution in that ground state manifold. But let's assume that the ground state is unique. Then obviously, then this is empty. You will never be able to see it. So you're interested in trying to understand how do excitations look like. What is the physics on top of this ground state that you can observe? Because that's at the end what you will see in the experiment. So and these matrix product states or generalization of that, they give a very good way of capturing all the physics of the ground state. And now we would like to kind of build on top of that. We would like to see this as something like the Hartree-Fock reference state. Okay, like this matrix product state should play the role of your reference state. And now you're interested in kind of seeing how the physics is on top of that. If you kind of excite it, or you kind of like in quantum field theory also, of course, you start with the vacuum and then you're interested in kind of seeing what are particles, how you kind of build your Fock space or your Hilbert space on top of this. And actually, this can all be done in a very natural way for these matrix product states. So to do that, actually, the first thing that is important to realize is that the matrix product states, they form something like a manifold in your full Hilbert space. Okay, and it's actually a manifold. It's not so the right language for describing this. The geometrical language is actually in terms of fiber bundles, and this is very relevant if you want to use these ideas that I will tell now to actually implement or to do simulations. It's very important to realize that indeed somehow this manifold. Somehow there's many kind of points on that manifold that kind of correspond to the same physical state. So that's why it's something like a fiber bundle. And indeed, somehow this has to do everything to do with the fact that the matrix product states, this description is not unique. You can always do gauge transformations somehow on your matrices in your matrix product state that kind of give rise to exactly the same physical state. So this is, and actually it's exactly these gauge transformations that play a crucial role in if you want to kind of classify these phases of matter, especially the symmetry protected phases of matter. This is exactly kind of related to what are these kind of type of gauge transforms that you do. So you start with this insight that you have this manifold, a very low dimensional manifold in your humongously large Hilbert space. And then you realize that actually somehow you do time evolution, or you kind of try to find a minimum. So this minimum is kind of the minimum energy state would be some kind of would correspond to some extremal point of all states on that manifold with respect to the Hamiltonian that you're interested in. Okay, and then once you are there, you're in this point, somehow this corresponds to the ground state, and there's a very natural way of trying to describe the physics around that ground state. Somehow what happens if you have some fluctuations, if you have some kind of what happens if you would have some kind of low energy states, or what happens if you're interested in the momentary excitation. So what you do is just kind of take a tangent plane on that manifold, and you project your full Hamiltonian basically on that on that manifold, okay? Because this is a linear subspace, and somehow this tangent plane is obviously a linear subspace, you get exactly a quadratic Hamiltonian. It happens that somehow this is really a generalization of somehow what Bogoliubov de Gennes or somehow these random phase approximations, but to the language of matrix product states. You can really understand that while you find your variational minimum, then you kind of are in the point, you take the tangent plane, project your whole Hamiltonian on that tangent plane, and this is a linear subspace on which you kind of can define now an effective Hamiltonian. Okay? Once you have this effective Hamiltonian, it turns out that actually there's a very nice way of understanding this the states that parameterize that tangent plane in terms of something like you have your matrix product states and you take them, all these matrices are, I'm assuming transition invariants, then all these kind of matrices are equal to each other except somehow one. Instead of an A in your matrix product state, you change it with a B and you take a superposition of this B being there, and so further. So you can easily see that this captures the physics of a tangent plane, because a tangent plane has to do with the derivatives. You take the derivative of your kind of manifold with respect to your parameters and your A, and of course, if you take a derivative, you have to take it here, plus there, and so further. And this is what it gives rise to. Now, this ansatz is actually very, very reminiscent to what people in condensed matter have been using for a long time. It's called the Feynman-Weyl ansatz, or somehow I think there's many, many different names for that. The single mode approximation is also somehow kind of related to this, namely that somehow this is very much like you act with a local operator on your physical things here, plus somehow you add a phase and you act there, plus and so further. So this is an ansatz. So all these states in that tangent plane are of that form. Okay, now somehow you can, because of the it's still a simple matrix product state, you can really project your original Hamiltonian onto that subspace. And you do that for something like the spin one Heisenberg model, and you diagonalize that effective Hamiltonian in that subspace, and you, of course there's still good quantum numbers like momentum and so forth, and you do that, and you can just read off somehow what the gap is, or the dispersion relation. So the full dispersion relation of your kind of energy as a function of momentum, which it's only this lowest branch that has any meaning. And the Galden gap, I don't know, you can describe it with somehow more than 10 digits of precision using this method, much, much more precise than if you would use DMRG and then somehow quantum numbers to. So this is really the most precise way of kind of determining somehow dispersion relations. So this really captures the physics. So if you want to understand what is the nature of an elementary excitation and an eigenstate on top of my ground, it happens that indeed this is completely captured by this ansatz. Okay, so this is. Of course, you could say, yeah, but this is not the whole story. What happens if you have symmetry breaking, then my elementary excitation cannot be of that kind. Then it must be something like a domain wall. Okay, but that's not a problem. Then you can just adjust somehow. This is when you have some degeneracy, if you have symmetry breaking. You take somehow one type of A's to the left, the other type of A's to the right, and these B's would somehow be the domain walls that connect these two things. And you can add this. You can, again, do the whole calculation. And you find somehow in this case, this is the spin one XXZ model. These red dots are actually the lowest excited states in that topological non-trivial sector. So you can identify all the possible excitations. You can kind of write down the dispersion relations, basically no cost. So there's no optimization, or there's nothing done anymore. All this information is really encoded in the ground state. So once you have the ground state in your Hamiltonian, you don't have to do any optimization anymore. You just put it there and you get all the dispersion relations. So you get really all the physics, the lowest lying physics.
Do you have to optimize one tensor?
Yeah, one red box. That is different from the rest of
it. Yeah, but that's an eigenvalue problem. This is what you get. You have to diagonalize that effective Hamiltonian. Okay, but there's no variational sweeping or anything there. It's just diagonalizing that matrix, and the cost of that is actually the same cost as one step in the MRG. Okay, so surprisingly, actually, this also, you would think, yeah, but this is all this ansatz only works because you do that for gapped systems. Okay, this is the fact that you have such an ansatz that is localized, and that these excitations that you can characterize these eigenstates with some local operators. This will break down if you have a critical system. That actually it happens. So we also can do these matrix product states for continuum systems. Okay, so there's some kind of something that's called continuous matrix product states, and it really captures all the physics of matrix product states, but for field theories. And we looked at somehow the, let's say, the Ising model of these field theories, namely the Lieb-Linegar model, which has physics very similar to the Heisenberg model. And we looked at somehow the elementary excitations in that case using this ansatz, using this kind of Feynman-Weyl type of ansatz. And we can reproduce really the beta ansatz result, because this model is solvable by beta ansatz, to, I don't know, 6-7 digits of precision. So you capture all the kind of elementary excitations. And this was actually not known somehow in this Liebknecht model, if you look at the literature. So people would tell you that there is no local kind of description of these elementary excitations, because somehow elementary excitations always occur in pairs. You have to kind of create a hole and a particle and so further. But using this ansatz, we could really identify that, no, that's not true. There is actually a local description of these spinon type of things. Okay, so these are very much very similar to spinons, and you just have to use this topological non-trivial thing, plot this, and then add two of these particles, and then you get the usual kind of dispersion relation of the Liebknecht. So it even works in the critical. So for critical systems, this also reproduces the known bad ansatz results to arbitrary precision. So it really captures something that is. It really shows that indeed these elementary excitations, they are kind of there is some notion of locality there.
Sorry, are you writing the Hamiltonian,
right?
That's the Hamiltonian of the system, or
is the... That's the Hamiltonian. So, I didn't explain what the Hamiltonian is. So this is just, you have bosons. Okay, and they have some kinetic energy, and they have some kind of delta potential. Okay, so there's bosons interacting via delta potential. And it happens that this is, this is actually a model that is critical everywhere, independent of this kind of C. If the C becomes very, very large, then this is called the Tong-Girardot kind of limit. And this actually becomes equivalent to free fermions. Because of course, if the C is very large, then two bosons can never be on top of each other, and the wave function must be antisymmetric, and then you recover basically the physics of fermions. But this is much, much richer because of the C. I don't know exactly what the value of C is for this, but somehow it looks the same a bit everywhere. But somehow you can really reproduce the exact excitation spectrum by just looking at this tangent plane in your manifold. So this gives you the whole thing. Okay, so... So of course, when we saw that, we wanted to have some kind of more theoretical, theoretical justification. Why is it actually that indeed this is a good ansatz? Why is it that we can understand excitations with this ansatz? Okay, and so for this somehow, so in the last, I don't know how much minutes I have left.
37 minutes.
Okay, so in the last 5 minutes, I would like to explain somehow, to show that indeed somehow there is some theoretical justification for having an ansatz like that. I will assume that I have a gapped system, and that my dispersion relation, so this is momentum versus energy, has kind of an isolated, or in this case, two isolated kind of branches. So these would be kind of two isolated branches that correspond to two different types of excitations. And what you can actually prove, again, using the very similar techniques actually to the ones that I used for proving this area law, namely Lieb-Robinson bounds and things like that, that if your dispersion relation looks like that, then necessarily these excitations can be kind of captured by the ansatz that we have. So if you have an isolated branch in your dispersion, because of course above that somehow then you get a continuum. Okay, this is so in the case of a spin. Let me kind of go back to this picture. This is the spin one Heisenberg model. So what you have is actually here, this is an isolated branch, and everything somehow above this green, starting from this red somehow, all of this is actually a continuum. Okay, so this is an example of a dispersion relation that has an isolated branch starting from here to there, and everything above it is a continuum. And actually, the way you can understand this is that comes out of these theoretical kind of investigations, that indeed somehow all these particles that live on this isolated branch, that these ones are exactly the ones that can be captured, that live on that tangent plane. And everything else above it, all this continuum, is nothing more than two particle excitations or three particle excitations and so further. But the nice thing is that actually these excitations, they are local, and the size of how local they are is not governed by the gap, but actually by the gap above it. So the gap between somehow this single branch and the continuum above it. So this kind of length scale determines the size of somehow the operators by which you have to act on the ground state to get an exact eigenstate. So these are really, these are not quasi-particles, these are basically the exact eigenstates. There's not much explanation of why or how do you prove this. But as I see here on my side, maybe on the next slide, but no. actually, the line of proof goes as follows. So you assume that there is some local operator that would have some overlap with an exact eigenstate. Okay, some it might be tiny, it might be exponentially small, but you assume that if you would kind of look at your dispersion relation, that at least there's a tiny kind of, might be exponentially small, but you excite a tiny fraction of your delta peak, of your exact excitation. Okay, so what you have is this there is a local operator. This could be just some kind of a psi or an A dagger or something like the typical operator by which you kind of look at excitations. What we'll do then is actually apply this machinery of Lie-Provenson bounds to filter out all the other eigenstates. So what happens is that somehow if your dispersion relation looks like in the case of this spin one, it looks like this. So this is a continuum above this. So as you create some kind of a localized wave packet of psi. So this could be something like the integral over dx e to the ikx psi x dagger. Okay, this is like the operator by which you act on the ground state with the momentum k here. And of course, this would create a state that is a superposition of this thing plus all these kind of many other kind of two particle, three particle, four particle, whatever. It would kind of excite lots and lots of different things. But now with the machinery of Lie-Provenson bounds, you can actually change this. You can make somehow EIHT e to the minus IHT with some kind of a filter function very similar to the ones we described before that basically filters out all these components. Okay, something that is a filter that completely filters out everything else except somehow what is going on here in that region. And because there's nothing above that, somehow the size of this filter function will be governed by how far, what is the distance between this point and the continuum above it. And actually the fact that, so if this is very large, if the gap between this and everything above it is a large distance, then somehow this filter function will be, you will not have much constraints and this thing will not smear this operator psi x out very much. If it's very small though, somehow if you're very close to this continuum, then this has to be much more precise and the size of that excitation will have to be much larger.
So in your construction, in your answers, where is this filter function appearing?
Oh, this has nothing to do with the simulations.
Okay, but I thought you were going to justify that the answer is good.
Indeed. That's what I'm doing.
Okay. but this will, okay, so this is an...
I'm just saying, look, assume that there is some kind of an excitation. So for example, this thing that has some overlap with an exact... So it has some tiny overlap with the exact eigenstate. Okay, it can be exponentially small, it doesn't matter. It must have some small overlap. And then what I will do is change that operator by kind of acting with some Lie-Provenson type filter function. And this will smear out that local operator a little bit. And what you will be able to prove is that actually this operator acting on your ground state has a fidelity with the exact eigenstate that is exponentially that is exponentially close to one in somehow the size of that.
So you're going to show that you can act on locally on your chain.
Exactly.
No. The right excitation.
No. So at the end, somehow this thing, we will call this O. Somehow this will be something like dx e to the ikx O of x, which is now an operator that is a bit smeared out but localized around x. And this will be the exact eigenstate. Okay? And of course, then you have this, so I will not really explain this, but somehow there is some notion in matrix. So this is much more general. This holds in any dimension. This is a completely generic result, what I'm explaining here. This is not dependent on matrix product states or on two dimensions. This is true, or one dimension. This is true. This is a very generic.
So this looks like test quasi-particle.
But this is an exact eigenstate. This is the point. This is not dressed. This is not a quasi-particle that will decay. No, this is the exact eigenstate.
So you're meant to explain why the gap between the single particle state and the
state. Oh, no, but this. So you're assuming that. So given that your dispersion relations look like this, and actually, in all the gap systems that I have been seeing, this is always what is kind of going on.
Like in the left part of that picture, it comes down.
No, but this thing is exactly, if this is the gap delta, and this is at momentum pi, then this is exactly 2 times delta. So this thing here is actually a two-particle state of 2 pi, of particles with momentum pi. So this is why this goes down, and this is kind of a continuum. But this is 2 times delta. And this is, so this whole branch, so once you know these points, you can construct all of this immediately. Because momenta add up, and energies add up, because we are talking about a translation invariant system in the thermodynamic limit. So the only kind of thing that still has to be justified is when you have this like kind of local operator acting on a few sites, that indeed somehow for the matrix product states then, that actually this can be captured by erasing that and changing one A into a B. But this is true. This is actually standard kind of matrix product state business to do that.
Are you saying that all of X does not depend on the momentum?
Yes. Well, actually, it does depend on the momentum a little bit, but not very much. As I will show you, it depends very much on the momentum because this F depends somehow. So in this case, you will have to filter much, much more precisely than you have to filter here. And this will have the effect that this is much more spread out, and you see this, okay? So let me show this next.
But B is K dependent.
B is K dependent. Okay, so let's kind of look at the case of AKLT, which is a matrix product state with bond dimension 2. And actually, the ansatz that we are using here is as follows. So you have a kind of matrices A, and then you have one B, and then all A's. But somehow this B is acting on one side, or two sides, or three sides, or four sides, because the bond dimension, of course, is always fixed, is always 2. So the question is now, what is the bond dimension? On how many sides does this B have to act to capture somehow my excitation? So what you do is just kind of look at 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and you see that actually at around momentum pi, so this is actually momentum pi here, acting on two sides already gives you kind of the right result. Okay, so the energy does not go down anymore by taking a B that acts on three sides versus two sides. The energy doesn't change anymore, so you already converge. But if you're very close to this continuum here, this is the result for just acting on one side, this is the result for acting on two sides, for three sides. So you see, you have to act on many, many more sides to capture, to really get, to identify the exact eigenstate of that, of that model.
Yeah, B acting on three sides means that you change B, A in three sides.
Well, no, the B is actually something that acts on three sides together. So and indeed somehow you see here that, so the bounds that you derive using these Robinson bounds, this actually, all of this depends exponentially on the gap. And indeed, if you look at on how many sides, that is the support, I act on one side, on two sides, three sides. So you see, and you ask, what is actually how does the energy change by acting, having this better and better ansatz? Around pi, you see that this is decaying very fast, exponentially fast. So your precision of your kind of gap that you calculate increases exponentially in the support, in the size basically of that O, which is completely, completely consistent with this. But if you're very close to this kind of point where this one particle is absorbed by the two particle band, this decay is still exponential, but much, much slower, which is again completely consistent with this
idea. Is it fair to say that the cost of the calculation also grows exponentially as you?
No, of course. The cost of this particle is growing exponentially, but this is to justify, to show that actually this is the right, is the physics that comes on. So the question, you could ask, what is actually happening at this point when somehow the one particle band and the two particle bands start to merge? So what happens is that you see that indeed the extent, so this operator O somehow, the on how many sides it has to act, it keeps on growing. And actually, exactly at that point, the exact eigenstate, so somehow it ceases to exist, this operator, and it splits into two operators. An operator that acts here, and something very far from there. Okay, and this is exactly a two-particle excitation. Man. So you can understand this whole kind of thing in that, perfectly in that language of localized excitations.
So a new channel for TK of.
Indeed. So what happens here is that actually this exact excitation, there is not a single particle excitation anymore at that momentum. It doesn't exist anymore. Somehow that thing just decays into two particles.
But are these two particles at a constant distance?
No, they are everywhere. They are.
So how do you represent it in with the
time? You cannot represent it by that ansatz.
But what does it mean that you have the particle?
Well, it just means that this one particle ansatz, this ansatz that we have, is not suited anymore for representing this. But it's easy now to say, well, let me try an ansatz with two Bs. Okay, one B here, another B there, and kind of give it momentum. And then you see that exactly then it works.
No, but that's where I was asking. So this ansatz that you just mentioned with two excitations, would you have to change the relative position of the two?
Well, that's the next slide. Okay. So the next thing you can do now. Let me just get to the previous slide. So what you want? So what is clear is that all these kind of excitations here in this isolated band, they are particle-like, okay? Because there's some localized description of what they are. So these are actually what people in quantum field theory kind of would call particles. And actually, this result that we just derived is a non-relativistic analog of a very famous result of a guy called Zimmermann, where he proved that indeed, if you have kind of a relativistic a Lorentz invariant kind of theory, that all the elementary excitations, the exact eigenstates, must be completely localized. Okay, this is actually a non-relativistic analog of that theorem. So now you have identified your particles, and what you want to do now is to build a Hilbert space of these quasi-particles, or these excitations. Okay, so you want to build now on top of your non-trivial vacuum, because somehow this is, on top of your matrix product state, of your PEPs or your MERA, you want to describe now an effective Hilbert space of these excitations. And the first thing you can do is, of course, take just a two-particle space, and you diagonalize over Hamiltonian in that two-particle space, and you can easily kind of, it happens that you can easily kind of come up with the S matrix. So the S matrix has to do with what are the asymptotic properties of these two particle states. You can exactly calculate this and you get this kind of numbers. So this would be somehow the momentum difference. So this would be like in the case of this AKLT, you take one with pi plus or minus x, you take these two particles and try to identify what is an exact eigenstate of these two particle state. Now, that means that if they are very far from each other, the only thing that matters is the relative phase. So if one is there and the other one is there, or this one is there and the other one is there, the only thing that matters in scattering is actually the relative phase. Using somehow this machinery of matrix products, it's very, very easy to actually kind of find what this phase is, and then this gives kind of plots like this, and this out of this, like the derivative around zero gives you the scattering length and
So you're saying that you start with your ground state, now you put particles in two places, and so the Hilbert space, the dimension of this effective space is only quadratic.
Exactly.
In the linear size of your system.
Yes.
And now you're diagonalizing that.
Well, it's even much better than quadratic. Somehow there's very few variables that you need, because you're only interested in the lowest energy states, and there's just one B basically that describes that low energy thing. So you have actually only, you get really a Hamiltonian.
The position. The
indeed, that's the only position. So you get
the relative one.
So you get basically a one particle problem.
You get
the problem of one particle. So, and of course, you can determine somehow what is the interaction between these excitations. So what you get then, and this is what we are kind of working on for the moment, is you can now look at what happens if I have a finite density now of these excitations. Okay, you get another effective Hamiltonian describing this, and you can then, in principle, use again the matrix product method, so whatever you want to describe this, and this is, so you can kind of build on that. So this is a systematic way of basically deriving these effective Hamiltonians or field theories that describe the excitations on top of your vacuum. So it feels that somehow using this language, we can do that in a systematic way. We don't have only to look at the symmetries or whatever the properties of your excitations and then guess, well, this must be this field theory. No, we can do it in a systematic way. You can really derive what this Hamiltonian is, the Hamiltonian that kind of describes the interaction between the quasi-particles. And that's basically it. Thanks for the attention.
Any more questions? Related to my remark on quasi-particle, I was thinking of another famous problem, the polaron problem, so-called Einstein polaron. You have Einstein oscillators at each side, they are not interacting. When you add an electron, they interact with them. Then as it moves, it carries a polarization with it. That turns out to be a non-trivial many body problem. So that's like,
but there is in principle kind of a nice kind of linear combination of all these things that is an exact eigenstate.
Correct, exactly.
Indeed. And so that's the ones that.
So your method perhaps will be suitable there.
Exactly. to describe this combined
exactly.
Kind so of this dressed particle. Again, this would be the exact eigenstate.
So it would be more illustrated.
Indeed. Well, the other things that of course I didn't talk about, once you have this one and two particle thing, you can immediately also write down Green's functions.
Mm-hmm.
Like Green's functions of the two particle contribution to the Green's function. Okay, and this well, once you have this language, this is actually completely straightforward to do that. So this is a really a different way of getting this dynamical information out of your system without having to do time evolution and related things.
Can you see the scattering length blow up when this gap is
No, this goes to pi, no? This is the phase.
Oh, that's the phase.
This is e to the,
yeah.
This is the phase.
Yeah.
So it goes to, well, somehow, it's strange, indeed, this kind of seems to bend down a little bit. But at the end, like the scattering length, the only thing you need is the derivative. You see that it's kind of nicely linear, and you can re-extract the scattering
what,
length.
What is the x and y axis?
So this is the phase. This is the phase versus x. So the momentum difference between your two. So you have a scattering state of two particles, one with pi plus x, the other one with pi minus x. And this is the scattering phase between these two. So this is actually the phase that you need to describe the exact eigenstate of two elementary excitations.
So the way you construct the excitation is similar to like in other phase, we construct spin wave by spin small deformation. So is there something like a generalized version of Goldstone theorem that tells me at what state do I start with? If I start from some MDS or TDS, it will give me gap detection.
Well, so what I showed you is that if you have a gapped system with some kind of isolated branch, then there's guaranteed to be somehow a solution like that. But I don't, in a gap, so what you're talking about is, of course, a gapless excitation. I think that it turns out that it still works because we kind of have tested this on critical models and the same physics seems to kind of emerge there.
Yeah.
So,
but there should be something determined by the ground
state. It is, at the end, it's all in the ground state. No? This is just a tangent plane. It's nothing more than the projection of your Hamiltonian on the tangent plane. And you get an effective new Hilbert space that describes all the physics of the one particle. This is the one particle physics on top of the vacuum that is described in that tangent plane.
I don't see any more questions, so...